This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
Yes, ladies, gentlemen, persons of indeterminate gender, alien beings of multiple genders, dogs, whatever, welcome to the first ever BristolCon Foundation reading. My name is Cheryl Morgan, and I'm your host for tonight. I apologise for the posh dress. I was at a civic event in Bath with the mayor this morning, and I didn't have time to go home and get changed, but there you go. Before getting into the events for this evening, I just want to say a little bit about the history of stuff like this, just to give you some idea of what we're actually doing here. If you talk to people in the science fiction and fantasy community about readings, the first thing they will think about probably is the KGB bar in New York. And they've been having readings there for many, many years, and a lot of the big names from New York publishing houses tend to turn up there regularly. They get really big name authors, of course, because, hey, it's New York, and that happens. A few years ago, an author called Terry Bisson decided he wanted to have something similar to that in San Francisco. And we set up what we call SF in SF, which is a reading series for the Bay Area. The West Coast publishing scene isn't quite as dynamic as the East Coast one, but okay, we have Tachyon Publications, we have Nightshade Books, we have Locust Magazine, and so on. So we get quite a lot of big-name authors to that one as well. There currently isn't anything of that type in London. There did used to be. Back when there was a Borders bookshop on Oxford Street, Pat Cadogan used to organise readings like this in London, but that kind of went away. And the closest they have at the moment is the British Science Fiction Association meetings, which is more of a single author interview than a reading. So currently there isn't anything like that in the UK, as far as I know, except for us. So that's New York, San Francisco, and Bristol. And that is where we are on the world stage. We, of course, have SFX, so thank you very much for Dave for coming along, and hopefully he can tell the world what we're doing. And in its little way, Wizards Tower Press will do a little bit to publicise things as well. I've been wanting to get something like this going for quite a while, and it's been quite difficult to sort a venue, and we owe a big debt to Claire here for having finally found us somewhere. So well done, Claire, for not only finding a venue but also getting 6 months worth of readings sorted out already, which is marvellous. I also need to say thank you, of course, to the Shakespeare Tavern for letting us have this lovely room. I hope you will all be buying beer. We'll be giving you plenty of opportunity through the evening to take a break and buy more. And also their food is very good. They're taking orders for the food up until 8:45. So you still have time to get in a food order if you want.
Just chicken.
Yeah. Claire and Joe and Heather are all addicted to the Hunter's Chicken.
Yes.
But there are other things on the menu, and if you all eat the Hunter's Chicken, there may be none for them, and then there will be trouble. So, you know, just be careful about that. After the event, we do have a sales table here. Gareth has brought books, other people have got books, there are BristolCon memberships for sale as well. So hopefully we'll have something of interest for you there as well. And now we need to get on with the entertainment. We have two readings for you today. The first one is going to be Mavanwy Rodman. Mavanwy is a local writer, just starting out. She has a degree in creative writing from Bath Spa, and she's one of the writers who's been selected to have a story in the Airship-Shaped and Bristol Fashion anthology that Wizards Tower will be bringing out towards the end of the year. I think she's going to read to us today from a novel in progress, so can we have a warm welcome, please, for Mavanwy Rodman.
Yeah, so this is my work in progress, which I've even written all over the printout, so it's clearly not to finish, but there we go. But here goes. Jan. At nightfall, he made for a cluster of holy thorns that stood some distance away across the plain. They were in an indistinct and hazy form of shelter in the growing dusk, but there was nowhere else. He could not spend the night naked and alone with nothing at his back save the wind. He was too afraid. Besides, he couldn't spend any more time curled up in a ball with his eyes closed and his hands over his ears either. By the time he reached the trees, stumbling awkwardly through the waist-high grass, his dark skin was bright with beads of blood. The grass leaves were as sharp as blades, and when he collapsed into the hollow dirt beneath the spread branches of the half-bent trees, he looked down to see that his body was covered with hundreds of tiny cuts. They stung viciously, and his bare feet throbbed, but he ignored the pain, pulling himself upright again there in the growing dark. His mouth was bitter with grit and dust, and thirst lay dry upon his tongue. Crouching in the stark shadow of the hunchback thorns, he sank questing fingertips into the soil at his feet. He sought a drop of dew, a damp pebble, mud that he could lick from his skin, any form of moisture. The trees must live on something. He pursed cracked lips and tasted salt. Please, please. His fingers scratched and scrabbled at the hard, dry earth, leaving behind scrapings of skin and broken nails. Blood spilled onto the ground like an offering. But the earth beneath his touch remained as dry as bone. He bit back a whimper. His skin was thick with dust, and when he swallowed, his throat rasped at the movement. When he blinked, his eyes burned. For one mad moment, he considered chewing on the grass blades, though he knew they would slice his mouth to ribbons. Instead, he licked the drops of blood from his tattered hands until the inside of his mouth was clogged with dirt. He sank back into the shadow of the trees, lying with his body against the rough thorn bark and ignoring the stabs of pain as it grazed his unprotected back. Beneath him, grains of cracked earth, dried grass roots and flints pressed into the soft nakedness of his skin, some hard enough to bruise. But he was too exhausted to move. He curled there, shivering, the taste of his own blood lingering in his mouth, while above him, visible through spreading branches, an impossible sky, bright with stars as fierce as beacons and a pale sliver of moon, arched like a temple roof, so high that it seemed unreal. And whimpers gave way to breathless sobs. Somehow, later he slept. And when he woke, nothing had changed, except that the sun was rising. He swallowed thickly as shivers ran along his exposed skin. The grass roots made him wince as he moved. During the night, the wind that had seemed a constant part of the plains, its bitter edge tinged with ice, had died down. But now as the sun began to rise, turning the sky pink and gold, it stirred again, cold gusts rushing through the bent branches of the thorns. The copse did offer some shelter, and the wind was not as hard as it had been the day before when he was out in the open. Sleep seemed to have helped too, and for the first time in hours he could think clearly. He gathered himself together, forcing pain and thirst from his mind. He would find water, and food, and people. He would survive. He only needed to try harder. Slowly he climbed out of the hollow beneath the thorn copse and stood up at the edge of the grass. What he saw there almost sent him cowering back under the thorn again. Grass, as tall as his waist, wind-washed and rippling, spilled out as far as he could see before him, rising to meet only the pale sky somewhere so far distant it made him feel dizzy. There were no houses, no streets, no people. He swallowed again. He felt sick. There was nothing. He pressed torn, dirty hands against his eyes. He knew if he turned round he would see more of the same, a terrible nothingness of grass and sky, and in the hazy distance, mountains. He squeezed his eyes tight shut and summoned images of home. The great square at sunset, the temple doors open for a holy day, the harbour glinting in the heat of the noonday sun, the constant tumble of voices, the rumble of cartwheels, the scents of spice and fruit and fresh baked bread washing over him. Fresh, clean water set out in an earthenware cup. Eyes still closed, he reached out to grasp it. Cold fingers touched grass leaves so sharp they stung his fingertips, and he opened his eyes. The grass rippled and hissed as the wind spilled over him, grazing his skin with dust drawn from the parched ground. The distant mountains drew him, as if he were some homing messenger bird. Beyond their white-tipped peaks lay safety and civilization, and, far to the south, his lost home. He shivered as the wind caressed his face, his roughly shorn head. The newly risen sun beat down upon his bare shoulders. The mountains could lead him home, but they were forbidden to him. His home was forbidden. He was a creature of the grass and the wind now, and he wondered how long it would be before they killed him. He licked cracked lips, wrapping his arms tight about his nakedness, but he could not keep the wind or the whisper of ice that it carried from scouring into him. He wondered if it would blow him away in the end, strip him down to bones, and then grind the bones to a dust that was settled to feed the grass at his feet. The thought sent a splinter of panic running through him. Stop it. You're cold and thirsty. You haven't eaten or drunk for days. The last time had been while still within sight of Anchor's city gates, before his escort decided there was no use in wasting good rations on the dead. He shook his head to clear it, and a wave of dizziness washed over him. You need to find water. But the trees had been his only hope. Where else could he look? Where is the water in this damned place? He stared out over the grass, as if he would somehow find the answer. But the grass seemed endless as an ocean and just as hostile. Still he stared out into it, narrowing his burning eyes against the glare of the sun, until a sudden violent gust of wind almost dropped him to his knees, and shaking and sobbing, he crawled back under the shelter of the thorns. Leaning his back against the now familiar rough bark, he curled his arms around his knees, laid his head upon them, closed his eyes and surrendered to his fear. The fear that had travelled with him from the moment Imperial troops had burst in upon his right of making, with drawn blades in their hands. I'm going to die. Tears rose behind his closed lids. He had thought he was done with tears. He had thought he'd cried himself dry in the Emperor's prison, in the judgment circle, as he was led from the palace gates in chains. He had wept for days, it seemed, uncaring that others might think him a coward. His misery so complete it consumed him. And even then, he could never have imagined something as terrible as this place, this nothingness of grass and sky. The Imperial judgment had offered him clemency. He had been given exile instead of death. Or was exile just a way of killing me, far away from my family and the court? Exile from the Empire meant banishment from everything and everyone he'd ever known. It meant being cast naked into the wilds beyond Imperial control, a place purportedly full of dangerous beasts and savage lesser men. It meant hunger and thirst and a bitter wind at his back, his bones lying lost and forgotten in this endless sea of grass. No one had ever returned from Imperial exile. No one. Had they all died like this? Crouched beneath a thorn tree, sobbing into the dirt? I'm going to die. His body ached, cold and pain and sorrow rising up from deep within like a tidal wave. The Emperor's sentence stretched before him, cold and empty, hard with pain and fear. The number of years seemed impossible, just a count of empty words. I can't survive that long. I'm dying right here and now. His dry mouth ached. I'm dying. Thoughts sunk into him as he shuddered beneath the thorns. The realisation that he could lie here and let pain and fear and thirst take him flooded through him. He would be one more lost exile, bound never to go home. It would be over. He could let the Emperor win. Then behind his lids, he saw the glitter of Yanish Irakai's eyes as he spoke the words of judgment from the Imperial throne. He felt the eyes of the court upon him, but the one pair of eyes that he most desperately sought was absent. He remembered the murmur that sprang up in the watching crowd. Exile, and for one who was so young. He thought he had sensed sympathy there among the watching faces, and he had closed his eyes, had waited, hoping that someone would speak, that someone would save him, but no one did. When he opened his eyes, he saw not the crowd, not Yanish on his iron throne, not the circle of judgment at his feet. No, when he opened his eyes, he saw only him, the boy who had lied, standing so still and so calm in the face of the thing he had wrought. Even as the memory filled him, Jan's ragged fists clenched and a wave of fury spilled through him. He drew in a deep, wavering breath. He felt again the firmness of his grandfather at his back, holding him steady as the sentence shook him, holding him up when he would have fallen. He heard his grandfather's words. Whatever your fate, my child, remember your name. You will always belong to the House of Imbir, yet Jan. You will always be the son of my son. He saw the look in his grandfather's pale eyes, a silent plea. I love you. Be strong. Survive. He had reached out and grabbed his grandfather's hand, holding tight to his warmth and the strength in those long, clever fingers. I didn't do it, he grated, struggling to find the words to speak past fury and fear. You know that, don't you, grandfather? You know he lied. I love you, my child. As he was taken from the Imperial Palace, his head shorn in shame, his hands bound before him, only his grandfather had come to watch him go. He looked back until the bend of the road took the sight from him, the tall, dark figure standing motionless on the white palace steps, unheeding of the tears that spilled down his cheeks, those hard grey eyes that never left his. Be strong, Jan. Survive. Survive. The soft-spoken words, cracking beneath the dryness of his tongue, fell into the call of the wind. He had been exiled to his death with a lie, but he would not let the Emperor's judgment kill him. He raised his head, fighting against the hollowness that filled his limbs, the thirst that burned in his throat. He would survive. He would see, once again, his own house, his own people, his grandfather's grey eyes. He would stand before Yanish Irakai, holy emperor, a free man. And then he would find the boy who lied. For a fleeting moment, he thought he felt the strength of his grandfather, the lord of his house, stern and strict and sure as stone, rise about him, filling his limbs with heat, banishing horror and fear. Then a finger of wind brushed against him and he shivered, the moment lost. But the memory of strength remained, and somehow he dragged himself to his feet. Somehow he stumbled up and he straightened. There must be water somewhere, there must be. Knowing the spikes of pain that ran through his legs from the leaf cuts, he staggered out from under the thorn once again. He fought the wind to stand and look up and out. The wide sky above was so vast against the endless grass that it made him feel tiny and more lost he'd ever been in his life. He could not tell which way to go. Each direction was the same, save one, and that was forbidden to him. He rubbed the tears from his face and looked up into the blue. Thin wisps of white clouds scudded across the vastness into whatever he could only guess at. And behind them, in the great distance, he saw something heavier, darker, heading his way, shadowing the distant grass. Rain clouds. Water. He sat there for what felt like hours, in the dirt just beyond the shadows of the thorns, tracing the passage of the rain clouds with his eyes and desperately praying that they would not turn from their course. Then he went back to the trees. From the thorn copse, he gathered all the dropped branches that had hollows or holes in them. It seemed to take him forever, and he fell more than once, leaving him with fresh bruises. Even his bones had begun to ache. He arranged the branches around himself in a circle, just beyond the shelter of the trees, with the hollows uppermost to catch as much of the rain as they could. There was nothing else he could do. If he had possessed clothes, or boots even, he would have spread them out too. He had nothing, not even hair on which to gather a few drops. As the storm clouds drew closer, the wind picked up, rattling the thorn branches and spitting violently against him, but he dared not move. He sat and shivered and watched his fingers turn blue with cold. He was beginning to feel as if death was stalking him. His legs were numb, his lips cracked and bleeding. He watched the sky grow dark. The rainstorm broke over him, the wind whipping up at its approach. Rain fell, cold as ice against his skin, over his face, into his open mouth when he flung back his head and let it. His lips stung at the force of the cascade and the earth about him turned to mud. The thorns shivered and creaked, and everywhere the sound of water hitting thundered in his ears. He let the storm take him, let it fill him as he huddled there in the mud. His legs shivered as the rain washed clean his torn skin. He lifted up his palms and watched the water flood across them. He wondered if it would wash him away forever. He closed his eyes against the stinging droplets and felt the soothing coolness of rain in his mouth, against his tongue, running down his throat. Water. Water. So much that he feared he could not drink it quickly enough. He cupped his hands to catch more, felt his drenched skin expand in response to blessed wetness. Then as quickly as it had come, it was gone. The wind died back to its familiar, steady constancy. The thorns grew quiet and the sun spilled out again. He watched the rain clouds speed away and breathed about, prayer of thanks. The woods he had laid out held tiny pools, though most were muddied or scummed over with sap and rot. Still, it was enough for him to save a little for later, if he were alive later, and he stored the branches carefully in the hollow beneath the trees. He realised that if he lay down at the edge of the hollow on the bare earth just beyond the shadow of the thorns, he would be in full silent sunlight, but sheltered from the bite of the wind and the knife edge of the grasses. The warmth of the sun upon his bare skin was glorious, and he lay there drowsing as the day slipped on towards evening. Deep inside him there was an ache of hunger, but he was bone-tired and so warm that he let the sunlight hold him and he did not move. Besides, he had no food, and by tomorrow the rest of his water would be gone. He could not rely on a rainstorm every time he got thirsty. You're still going to die, it's just going to take a little longer, that's all. And yet, for some reason, lying suffused in heat and light, the idea of death didn't seem so bad. He found himself smiling as a breath of wind reached down from above and caressed his shorn head. Look at me, the son of one of the first families of the Empire, rolling around in the dirt like a beast. Laughter bubbled up from his throat, though he did not understand why, spilling out from between his broken lips. He turned his head and looked down at his hands. His fingers were twined idly about a clump of grass stalks. He looked at the palms, they were soft, uncalloused, but his nails were broken, his wrists rubbed raw from the manacles he'd worn during the weary 2 month journey from the Emperor's dungeons. His knuckles were torn from yesterday's desperate search for water, and as he looked at them, he felt the sudden smart of broken skin and bruises. I'm worried about grubbing in the dirt while I'm naked and shamed. The laughter rose again, though this time the edge of it was bitter and as brittle as glass. So, it's warm lying here, and it took me hours, but I found water. Now I'm hungry, but I've no food. What do I do next? Can I catch something with my bare hands? He let himself think about it, closing his eyes against the brightness of the sun. Well, there should be beetles, grubs. I could try digging up the grass roots. They can't be as sharp as the leaves, surely. Can I live on that? Can I live on that for years? He shivered. Something had crossed between him and the sun. a broad, long shadow. A fierce cry rose above the hiss of the wind, echoing all around him, and he sat up, looking to the sky. A great hawk was wheeling overhead. Its vast wings, over 7 feet in span, were spread wide, its body a silhouette. No longer warm, he felt a sudden skittle of fear across his skin. Great hawks were dangerous. Fiercely territorial, they lived mostly in mountainous areas, where they were hunted ruthlessly by hill farmers for their love of taking newborn lambs, and they were capable of killing a man if they hit him at the right angle. If a great hawk could kill a full-grown man, then what one would think of a scrap of skin and bone barely out of boyhood? Jan's heart pounded in his ears as the hawk's hunting keen shivered again across the wide arch of the sky, and it made another pass, flying closer this time. 5-inch talons, sharp as any blade, glinted in the sunlight. He scrambled to his feet, unthinkingly starting away from the thorns, moving out into the plain where there was more space to manoeuvre. Don't run. All hunters give chase to prey that run. Don't run. With a sudden scream, the hawk dove downwards, talons gaping, cutting between him and the thorn trees, driving him forward. The dull gold in its dark brown feathers flashed in the sunlight. He turned and ran. He felt the shadow of the hawk as it crossed above him, and he ducked his shoulders as the bird hissed over his head. He drew in a sharp breath, stumbling into the tangle of grass, fighting the pull of it against his legs as he fled, sharp leaves cutting into his flesh, slicing his fingers when he pushed them aside, but he barely noticed. The hawk shrieked, passing once more, diving closer now as if taunting him. He ducked and fell to his knees, the impact jarring through his whole body. Then he was up and running again, heading into the grass ocean, leaving his shelter far behind him. He should have run back under the thorns, stupid to panic, stupid. Out here, he sensed, stupid got you killed. The hawk called and dove. He ducked, but not quick enough. He felt a wrenching tear as crooked claws scraped across his shoulders and back. He screamed and fell to his hands and knees in the dirt. Gasps, sobs tumbling from his lips, muttered prayers for mercy that made no sense even to him. He crouched there, close to the ground, and awkwardly craned his head in an attempt to see the damage the hawk's claws had done. But it was useless. All he could feel was the sharp, biting sting of pain and the hot, wet fall of his own blood down his back. It hurt to rise, it hurt to move, and he felt sick deep in his stomach. Because this was not the pain of scraped skin or bruised bone, this was the pain of a real wound. The skin of his back was gaping open. He swore, wiping tears from his eyes and shoving panic away from his thoughts. If he was bleeding to death, then he was bleeding to death, but he wouldn't stop running until he had to. He looked skywards. No sign of the bird. Somehow he stumbled to his feet, and swaying with each forward step, he ran on. He fell again twice before the hawk came back, and this time, as it wheeled over him, he ducked down deep into the grass, covering his head and face with his arms. The hawk screeched in fury as the tall grasses sliced at its taloned feet. He lay there, panting hard, his head spinning as he waited for the next attack. He couldn't run anymore. His back felt as if it was on fire, and the pungent scent of blood filled the air about him. He could feel it dripping down into his legs now, hot with the flow of his life. And every time he moved his shoulders, his flesh spasmed in protest. His arms and legs were trembling, his breath heaving out in hollow gasps. Grandfather, I'm sorry. I'm not strong enough. I'm sorry. He heard the hiss of wings overhead, a rush of air as the great bird sped down towards him. I'm sorry. Shadowed wings passed across the sun a second time, and he tensed, ready for a final hit to the back of his head, the killing blow. A sharp whistle sounded across the plain, hard and bright against the shimmer of his fear. And against the thudding of his heart, he felt a heavier, slower rumbling as it spread through the ground where he lay, the soil shuddering beneath his prone body. He tensed. Horse hooves. He raised his head, though it hurt, and looked up between the blades of grass. A group of mounted men were riding towards him across the plain. Horse and rider moved as one, spreading out to form a loose semicircle around him as they approached. His body tensed as they came closer. He knew what they were doing, of course. He'd hunted on his family's country estate since he was old enough to be lifted into the saddle. They were attempting to flush him out, leaving him only one way to run, and it was working. He felt panic spill through him and he staggered to his feet. The riders were mere yards away when he turned and ran again. There was more stumbling, really, and he couldn't see where he was going anymore. Grey spots kept dancing before his eyes. Pain jolted through him at every step. He limped pathetically through the grasses, his head hanging, the breath burning in his throat, tears in his eyes. He could hear the riders behind him. They had slowed to a walk and were simply following him, waiting for him to fall on his own, no doubt. No need to hurry when the prey was so obviously spent. At last, he forced himself to stop. He was at the base of a short, round hillock, which offered some slight protection to his back, and he could go no further. Slowly, he turned to face them. His body was trembling, his breath heaving in his chest as he watched them move in. They walked towards him, in a semi-circle formation, though it was tighter now, no gaps for him to dart through. 12 riders, clad in wool and leather with thick fur hats on their heads, from which dark braids fell, each one tipped by a copper bead. They wore white-handled long knives, a version of the traditional imperial weapon, or so it appeared, by their sides and composite bows at their backs. They didn't even need to catch me to kill me. The horses were strange, short and muscular and half the size of imperial mounts, with big heads, round bellies and stiff, upright manes. Their noses were dark, but their coats were light, mostly beige or brown, and they were not pretty, but their odd rolling gait seemed effortless, as if it could devour long distances with ease. The horses whickered to each other as they approached, and the rider stared at him with round, dark, commoner eyes. He fought not to shiver. They were lighter skinned than the commoners who served the Empire, but that only made the contrast between their lightness and his darkness more uncomfortable. He felt himself flush beneath their solemn stares. There was nothing servile about that look. What were they thinking? Had they ever even met one of the kin before? They acted as if he was prey, was he? They came closer, and he fought to hold his arms low to his sides, with the palms out in the imperial position of surrender. He fought not to run. He had nowhere to go. He wondered madly, briefly, if they had any food with them. And he staggered as dizziness threatened to drop him to his knees. They stopped a few feet away. The scent of leather and hide rose up above the cool, clean scent of the plains. A few hours ago, he had prayed to be free of the emptiness of the endless grass and eternal sky. He had prayed for people, and fate had sent him men who hunted him down with horses and hawks until he was little better than a beast at bay before them. He was shivering, and he could not seem to stop. The riders watched him from the backs of their round-bellied horses, unmoving, silent. What were they waiting for? He closed his eyes for a moment and imagined himself as they must see him, crouched there against the rise of the hill, blood-soaked and helpless. They would think him a child, though he had passed through his rite of mating, so they would see a naked boy whose body was bright with cuts and the patterns of thick bruising, with skin rubbed raw at the wrist and dark hair shorn close to his head. They would see the blood that had fallen from his torn back, the pain in his eyes, the fear. But they would see other things too, things that would be strange to them. They would see the kumai that curled blue-black across his chest and arms. They would see the skin as dark as burnt umber, and that, despite his youth, he stood taller than them by more than a head. He drew in a deep breath. They would look into his slanted eyes and see pupils the shape of a gibbous moon. They would see that he was kin, and it would change nothing. How could it? The commoners of the unoccupied lands were little better than savage beasts. They had no understanding of empire or 1,000 years of civilization. They did not avert their eyes in respect for his honoured presence or kneel to do his bidding. The sanctity of the ever-living meant nothing to them. He stifled a panic sob. They would look at him, at his darkness, at the kumai, at his kin eyes, and they would kill him just the same. The soft thud of unshod hooves sounded in the stillness, and he looked up. A rider was pushing forward from the circle, closing the distance between them. A few steps away they stopped and slid from the back of their mount, turned towards him with a long knife in one hard brown hand. Jan stiffened. The rider was dressed in a thick leather coat that fell to the knee and was fit for riding. Below the coat he caught a glimpse of thick wool breeches and a pair of heavy fur-lined boots. The rider's skin was a warm light brown, and his eyes were commoner dark. Like the other riders, he wore a heavy fur coat, but his hair was not visible under it. Instead, a black cloth concealed his hair and his neck and curved round to cover the bottom half of his face so that only his round pupilled eyes could be seen in a frame of soft brown skin. He was slighter than the others too, his body more curved and delicately boned, moving with a singular grace. Blade in hand, the rider moved through the grass on silent booted feet. The blade glinted in the dying light of the sun as it dipped toward the horizon. Jan tensed, wondering if he would look like a coward if he raised his hands to ward against the blow. Does it really matter whether they think you're honourable? You're going to be dead. Fear flooded through him. All his life he'd lived in wealth and security, the firstborn son of his house. And now who's going to die in ignominy in this empty place? His blood spilled out into the roots of the grass and devoured by the thirsty soil. He felt the weight of the rider's eyes as they moved across the grass towards him. And he felt himself stiffen, a sudden rush of anger running through him, his body flushing. They should be the ones to be afraid, the ones to cower in the grass. He was kin. He was their better in every way. How dare they gaze upon him unafraid? Even as the thoughts and the anger filled him, he realised how foolish he was being. They were the thoughts of another life, for other commoners. These men chose to kill him where he stood, naked amongst the grasses. There was absolutely nothing he could do about it. There was nothing great or powerful about him anymore. Kim bled and died just as easily as lesser men. He wanted to apologise to them then for his foolish thoughts and his useless anger. He wanted to beg them not to kill him and to ask for food and clothes. He considered kneeling down in the grass. Would that help? He raised his hands and pleaded, would they take him away from this, from the grass that tore the skin, from endless sky and wind? Take him somewhere safe and warm and dark, where he did not have to be afraid? He opened his mouth to try, but nothing came out. He did not have the words. And looking into those dark, round eyes, he thought that maybe they would kill him anyway. A stranger on the plains and so different from them. There was no reason for them to help him, none at all. Suddenly he was so tired. He was tired of being cold and hungry and lost. He was tired of being afraid. But he could not tell them that either. A sudden wave of weakness spilled through him, and his legs folded. He fell, pain jarring as he hit the ground hard, swallowing a scream. He had no more strength. He couldn't rise, he couldn't speak. There was nothing left. Blinking dazedly, he looked up, hands raised against the glare of the sun in his eyes, and saw the glint of light upon the edge of a blade.
Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue, and to Wizards Tower Press for hosting this podcast. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.